Pain has reached epidemic proportions in America. I'm Dr. Paul Christo. This is Aches and Gains.
Dr. Paul Christo is one of America's leading experts on relieving pain. He's board certified, Harvard trained, and a pain medicine specialist at Johns Hopkins. U.S. News and World Report ranks him as a top doctor and among the top 1% in the nation for pain management. Older adults, children, and even infants struggle to cope with pain. But there's hope, and there are treatments that can ease pain and suffering. The show offers compelling stories about people who found relief. We share cutting-edge treatments from contributing experts, and we offer ways to help people cope with their pain.
Welcome to the show. Cancer care is moving quickly toward precision medicine. That is, treatment that's guided by the tumor's biology and biomarkers instead of the location of the tumor in the body. Today's episode focuses on pan-tumor, optimizing treatment for tumor-agnostic HER2-positive patients, and what it means when HER2 becomes a target across multiple solid tumors. HER2 stands for Human Epidermal Growth Factor Receptor 2, which is a protein on the surface of cells that helps control growth signals. In some cancers, HER2 is present at unusually high levels or altered in ways that can drive tumor growth. This is why it's become an important biomarker and treatment target. Pan-tumor and tumor-agnostic mean that a treatment can be used across many different cancer types as long as the tumors share the same biomarker. In the past, HER2-targeted therapies were primarily approved for specific cancer types like breast and gastric cancers. More recently, the FDA has approved trastuzumab deruxtecan for use in many solid tumors that are HER2-positive and also metastatic or unresectable. That has expanded access to HER2-targeted therapies for patients otherwise not eligible for them. On today's show, we have as our guest Dr. Cesar Santamaria. He's an associate professor of oncology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and director of breast cancer clinical trials. He'll explain what tumor agnostic really means in the clinic, how HER2 testing and interpretation can vary outside of breast cancer, how newer HER2 targeted therapies are reshaping options for patients who historically wouldn't qualify, and finally, where the field is headed.
Aches and Gains is supported by the Institute for Continued Healthcare Education, Daiichi Sankyo, and Kowa Pharmaceuticals.
We're back with Dr. Cesar Santamaria. He's an associate professor of oncology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's been recognized with multiple honors, including the Scholar in Training Award and the American Society of Clinical Oncology Pain and Symptom Management Merit Award. Dr. Santamaria, welcome back to Aches and Gains.
Pleasure to be here.
On our last show, we talked about HER2 and why it's an important biomarker in oncology, how HER2 overexpression or mutation influences tumor behavior across different types of solid tumors, and then we got into guidelines, specifically the National Comprehensive Cancer Network and the American Society of Clinical Oncology guidelines, and how they currently address HER2 testing and treatment beyond breast cancer. I want to pick up where we were before, talking about challenges in HER2 testing and scoring for non-breast solid tumors. One of the challenges is heterogeneity is common and clinically meaningful. And I think what that means is, in many non-breast tumors, HER2 expression can vary from one tumor region to another. So a small biopsy might undercall or overcall eligibility depending on sampling.
That's true. And, you know, again, we deal with that a lot in breast cancer. I think it's particularly true at lower HER2 levels, but I will say there's certainly circumstances where we do a biopsy, you know, in a breast mass, it's HER2 positive, and a lymph node, it's HER2 negative. And, you know, there can be even a wide discordance across metastatic sites. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think whenever you're doing a biopsy, you know, I think about a patient with metastatic disease that might do a biopsy initially, but then they might consider a biopsy at progression. Those are things to consider that you might want to recheck on subsequent biopsies.
Okay, and then let's talk about different HER2 alterations and how they can point to different treatment pathways. That is, for example, in lung cancer, the gene mutations are key actionable categories within recommended molecular testing for advanced disease, which is different and a different question than the IHC scoring. So in other words, you can have HER2-related abnormalities, but they can point to different treatment pathways, and they're not interchangeable because the tumor type is different.
I would say to some extent, with the advent of trastuzumab deruxtecan, this kind of juggernaut of a therapy against any little bit of HER2 expression a tumor might have, it's become a little less relevant. And, you know, you can see like the one drug that really crosses the multiple histologies and has the tumor agnostic indication is that drug. Mm-hmm. I would say it's certainly one of the most active drugs in terms of targeting HER2. And it makes some of those nuances less relevant.
Okay.
With other types of anti-HER2 therapy, it's more relevant. For example, in breast cancer, we use tyrosine kinase inhibitors that are targeting HER2. And those are, you know, active really only in HER2-positive breast cancer, but also in HER2-mutated breast cancers. The original monoclonal antibody trastuzumab that really, for the most part, just works in HER2-positive disease. It doesn't work at these kind of lower thresholds. So, you know, I think it depends on the target and the drug. And I will say just again, in the day and age of trastuzumab deruxtecan, it's really questioning the central premise of oncologic receptor targeting, where, you know, it asks the question, how much receptor positivity do you need to have clinical benefit?
Right, exactly. And lastly, with respect to a major challenge, I feel, in HER2 testing and scoring for non-breast solid tumors, reproducibility. That is, reproducibility at the low end is tough, especially as HER2 low and ultra low enter the conversation.
Yeah, it's really important to understand, like right now, you know, when we say HER2 low or ultra low, this is a specific biomarker for a specific targeted therapy. It's not a unique biological entity. These tumors are not necessarily driven by HER2, where, you know, just like a monoclonal antibody can have significant activity. It's a dumb target, right? It's just a target, and, you know, for this very powerful antibody drug conjugate. You know, HER2 low and ultra are not disease entities as they are just specific biomarkers for a very specific drug.
And that's a distinguishing feature. So the biomarkers, the HER2 low, ultra low, then are really most beneficial with respect to trastuzumab deruxtecan. Is that right?
Exactly. Versus, like, you know, you wouldn't give a patient who's HER2 low or ultra low other antibody drug conjugates like trastuzumab and tamsin, for example, has really no activity in HER2 low and ultra low, mm-hmm. or even again trastuzumab or other tyrosine kinase inhibitors. It's not been shown to be active in these lower expression. It's just specific to trastuzumab deruxtecan at this time.
Well, let me ask you, what are the most effective HER2 targeted therapies currently available for solid tumors?
Breast cancer has really led the way in HER2 targeted therapies. You know, starting off with a monoclonal antibodies, trastuzumab. A HER2, HER3 monoclonal antibody, pertuzumab. Again, these are mostly breast-specific drugs. Another class of drugs that have been developed are the tyrosine kinase inhibitors. They're small molecules, and they target the intracellular domain of HER2. So it's a different way of targeting HER2. Instead of relying on the monoclonal antibody extracellular domain targeting, it's looking at intracellular targeting of the HER2 protein. The nice thing about tyrosine kinase inhibitors is that they are small molecules. And, you know, one feature of HER2-positive breast cancers in particular is that they have a predilection for the CNS, brain metastasis. So these small molecules do tend to cross the blood-brain barrier more readily, and they've been shown to have activity in patients with a central nervous system metastasis. And then, of course, we talked about the antibody drug conjugates. There's two on the market right now, trastuzumab and tamsin, which is an older one, and trastuzumab deruxtecan, this newer one as well. So what's interesting is that even though these are large molecules, we have seen pretty significant activity in the CNS with these larger tumors. Maybe not perhaps because of the way they cross the blood-brain barrier, but maybe because there's a perturbed blood-brain barrier.
I think the key is matching therapy to biology and indication. That is, HER2 immunohistochemistry 3 plus solid tumors may qualify for tumor agnostic trastuzumab deruxtecan after prior systemic therapy and when alternatives are limited. Some cancers have their own HER2 therapy pathways, like gastric cancer, for example, that's guided by disease specific evidence and HER2 testing standards. And then in certain settings, HER2 mutations, especially in non small cell lung cancer, can define a separate treatment pathway. We've got to take a break, but when we come back, we'll talk to Dr. Santa Maria about how the recent FDA tumor agnostic approval has changed clinical practice. I'm Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to Aches and Gains.
Aches and Gains is supported by the Institute for Continued Healthcare Education and by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo. To access podcasts of the show, please go to paulchristomd.com. That's paulchristomd.com.
Cesar, how has the recent FDA tumor agnostic approval changed clinical practice?
You know, I think it makes HER2 testing important irrespective of your disease site of origin, right? So, you know, it doesn't matter now that it's a breast cancer that's HER2 positive or a lung or GI cancer. Any cancer that's HER2 positive now has trastuzumab deruxtecan as a treatment option, and this is going to give access to this drug to more and more patients.
It definitely is. Now, let me challenge you. Do you feel that universal testing for HER2 for all solid tumors is warranted?
I think that's what this label actually means. Yeah, I think that for solid tumors, at least for metastatic solid tumors, HER2 testing is really part of the standard workup that should be done.
On the other hand, should we test every solid tumor in every situation? Because the prevalence and yield can vary a lot by tumor type.
Correct. There can be some variability, and we do test for biomarkers that are low prevalence. If it's positive, it's something that we would take action on. And I think this is true across many histologies. I think ultimately, it's certainly a discussion with the individual oncologist that looks at the patient scenario. You would think trastuzumab deruxtecan could be an option. Mm-hmm. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is definitely not an option for all because of some of its toxicities.
Let's talk about insurers now. Have you found that they're covering the cost of trastuzumab deruxtecan for, say, a tumor agnostic HER2 positive indication? Or, I mean, what have you found in breast cancer?
We've been using HER2 targeting therapies now for almost 2 decades. So it's really part of our standard workflow. And I think to your point, with an FDA label, even if there's a little bit of pushback initially, I do think it's something that would probably be pretty readily approved eventually.
Exactly. Now let's talk about side effects. I mean, what are the most common and most serious side effects seen with HER2 targeted therapies?
There's different ones depending on the agent. With the HER2 monoclonal antibodies, so things that have a trastuzumab backbone, cardiomyopathy is going to be kind of the main one. Mm-hmm. Trastuzumab itself is very well tolerated. Patients taking it really experience, you know, close to normal activities of daily living. With the antibody drug conjugates, we certainly see more toxicity. And I think the relevant one here to really talk about is trastuzumab deruxtecan. So we definitely see side effects that are more in line with chemotherapy than with what we typically think about targeted therapy. This has to do for a variety of different reasons, but you know, one of the key things about antibody drug conjugates is this bystander effect where, sure, you kill the cell and the cell apoptosis, but it can release free chemotherapy nearby. And that's probably why trastuzumab deruxtecan is as potent of an anti-cancer agent as it is, but it's also probably why it has the most toxicity.
Right.
It can cause side effects, again, very similar to chemo in terms of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. It can affect the white blood cell counts. About 40% of patients or more will experience alopecia. So very kind of typical chemo-like side effects. Mm-hmm. One of the unique side effects of trastuzumab deruxtecan, though, is the risk of pneumonitis or interstitial lung disease. And this can be a really serious thing because with the breast cancer experience where this drug was initially diagnosed across several phase 3 studies, we see that there's a small but important percentage of patients who experience fatal pneumonitis. They can have grade 5 lung toxicity, which, you know, speaks to You know, I was saying, you know, in the patient where you would think about treating with trastuzumab deruxtecan is where you'd want to test it. If it's a very low stage kind of tumor where surgery is probably enough, then probably don't need to be giving this patient trastuzumab deruxtecan. And I think it's important to be mindful of the potential serious toxicities that it can cause.
Absolutely. Now, are the side effects that you mentioned reversible, including the pneumonitis?
It can be. You know, unfortunately, any grade 5 toxicity is not going to be. That means, you know, patient died from that toxicity. With trastuzumab pneumonitis, we think about it according to its grading, toxicity grading. The pneumonitis risk is going to be very, very relevant. A grade 1 toxicity, so like the lowest grade toxicity, is basically a patient who's asymptomatic and only has imaging findings concerning for pneumonitis.
Okay.
This is really the only grade at which re-challenging is with trastuzumab deruxtecan is potentially possible. You know, certainly with someone with grade 1 pneumonitis from trastuzumab deruxtecan, you'd want to hold trastuzumab deruxtecan and you'd want to consider the use of steroids, sometimes a pulmonary referral. But if there's resolution within, you know, a few weeks, it's something that can be rechallenged. And there's actually data in breast cancer that you can successfully rechallenge patients with grade 1 pneumonitis with trastuzumab deruxtecan, which speaks to the importance of CT chest monitoring for patients being treated with trastuzumab deruxtecan. Unfortunately, there's no standard guidelines for that. In the breast cancer studies, it was done every 6 to 8 weeks. And, you know, typically in practice, we'll do it no more than every 3 months or so. Once there is symptoms, so there's symptoms plus an imaging finding, that's an automatic grade 2. And typically, trastuzumab deruxtecan rechallenge is not recommended. While the pneumonitis itself can be reversible with steroids, typically we would discontinue trastuzumab deruxtecan altogether for those higher level toxicities. And certainly grade 3-4 toxicities, higher grade toxicities that require perhaps hospitalization, we certainly would not want to rechallenge with trastuzumab deruxtecan. And I will say these higher grade pneumonitis, it doesn't reverse overnight. You know, typically patients will need to be on steroids for several weeks, often requiring oxygen. It can certainly be quite impactful.
Wow. Yeah, very, very true. It seems like we're in this era of precision medicine, personalized care in oncology treatments, especially with the antibody drug conjugate that we've been talking about today.
I think we're in the midst of the ADC era, where there is a plethora of different therapies using antibody drug conjugates or other drug conjugate strategies to target HER2. And HER2 is definitely a prime target of interest across multiple histologies. In breast cancer, we've gotten very, very good at treating HER2-positive breast cancer, where we're actually now moving more towards potential de-escalation or really therapy optimization, where we're starting to do studies looking at on-treatment biomarkers to help determine duration of or length of treatment. Once you're able to really effectively target HER2, there are these therapy optimization really becomes key, because there's different ways of targeting HER2, some ways more toxic than others. And I think that's kind of been the other side of the coin, where it is a very important target. We have very effective drugs against it. You know, as we're developing more and more drugs, it's also important to start really focusing on tailored algorithms for individual patients.
Absolutely. It's extremely exciting given that this area of treatment is evolving so quickly. When we return, we'll talk about how treatment is expected to evolve over the next 5 to 10 years. I'm Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to Aches and Gains.
Aches and Gains is supported by an educational grant from COA Pharmaceuticals America, Incorporated. For cutting-edge treatments and resources, follow Dr. Paul Christo on Twitter at Dr. Paul Christo and like Aches and Gains with Dr. Paul Christo on Facebook.
Welcome back. Cesar, how do you see treatment evolving over the next 5 to 10 years for tumor-agnostic HER2-positive care? For instance, do you think we'll see other HER2-directed therapies like pertuzumab being used, or drugs targeting the immune system?
I think so. We do use, for example, trastuzumab, the original monoclonal antibody, and GI cancers, right? So I do think that as you're establishing HER2 as a target, you're able to really use all the different ways of targeting HER2. And I think that's going to lead to more research in terms of different ways of targeting, perhaps less toxic ways or just different ways, whether it's the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, monoclonal antibodies. There's newer generation of monoclonal antibodies that engage the immune system a little more, for example. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think this is really going to open the field of HER2 targeting more broadly.
And what steps do you think community oncologists can take to improve HER2 testing and treatment decisions?
I think it's always good to have a good working relationship with your pathologist. Just making sure you have adequate tissue sampling is really important. Knowing your resources of testing HER2, again, whether it's an internal pathology lab, whether it's a send out to a central pathology lab or some sort of commercial NGS, there's different ways to get HER2 testing done. So certainly, I think it's important to have that communication with your pathology team that you work with to make sure that you're able to test for HER2.
I agree. How do you feel patients and caregivers can become more informed and advocate for optimal care these days, especially when HER2 is part of the conversation?
I do think as word gets out of this indication for trastuzumab deruxtecan and this agnostic HER2 testing indication, I think awareness is certainly very important to help self-advocate. Mm-hmm. I do find, you know, patients are certainly more and more savvy. There's a lot of information on the internet, both good and bad.
Right.
But I think with any oncologic relationship, I always tell my patients that the key to successful oncologic relationship is communication. You need to be able to talk to your oncologist and, you know, ask them about what are targeted treatment options that I might have. You know, even if you're not necessarily aware of HER2 specifically, that can be a little technical, asking them about, you know, what targeted therapy options they have. Are there any clinical trial options with them or with a local academic cancer center? I think is really key to the oncologic process, just that the process of communication.
Absolutely. I think that even asking for a second pathological review makes sense, especially if the results are borderline or the tumor type is uncommon. When we talk about molecular in terms of diagnosis or treatment, what we mean is that it's based on what's happening at the level of genes, proteins, or biochemical pathways, rather than just symptoms, organs, or what you can see on imaging. For example, a molecular diagnosis now relies on detecting specific biological markers, like we've talked about today, DNA mutations, for example, even RNA expression patterns, protein markers, and things like epigenetic changes. With respect to molecular treatments, well, we've got the targeted therapies that block mutated proteins, monoclonal antibodies like trastuzumab that bind to specific regions of the cell, gene therapies, and even RNA-based drugs.
Yeah, it's funny. I'll say, like, I feel like I'm glad I paid attention in biology 101 in college, because, like, all this stuff is kind of back. You know, I feel like you need to be a geneticist and immunologist.
You really do. I mean, you know, historically, HER2 positive cancers were treated in a strictly tumor-specific way. HER2 testing and targeted therapy were largely limited to breast cancer, as you mentioned earlier, and later to gastric and gastroesophageal cancers, because that's where HER2 biology was first validated. If HER2 overexpression or amplification was found in other tumors, like the lung or biliary colorectal or gynecologic cancers, it was often considered incidental or experimental. Broad molecular testing wasn't routine. Access to HER2 targeted drugs was restricted to specific cancer types, and early therapies required high, uniform HER2 expression, which limited their usefulness outside classical settings. Over time, though, advances in genomic sequencing changed this perspective. HER2 alterations were found to occur across many solid tumors, not just as amplification or overexpression, but also as activating mutations. This led to a broader understanding that HER2 is a driver oncogene in multiple cancer types, and that tumor behavior can be dictated more by molecular biology than by tissue of origin. Today, the approach is increasingly tumor agnostic. Patients often undergo broad molecular profiling early, and HER2 status is evaluated regardless of cancer type. Importantly, newer HER2 targeted therapies, especially antibody drug conjugates and irreversible tyrosine kinase inhibitors that you mentioned, are effective even in tumors with heterogeneous or lower HER2 expression. Dr. Santa Maria, what a great show. Thank you so much for being here today on Aches and Gains.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to Aches and Gains.
The views and opinions expressed in this radio program are solely the views of Dr. Paul Christo and do not necessarily express the views of this radio station and Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, nor an endorsement by any or all of them of any of its content. This show provides medical information, not advice. Please consult your personal physician before engaging in any course of treatment or use of any of the techniques or products discussed on this show. Discussion of particular uses of products on this show have not been approved by any of the manufacturers of such products. To access podcasts of the show, please go to paulchristomd.com. That's paulchristomd.com. Aches and Gains is produced by Ty Ford. Dr. Paul Christo is the executive producer. Thanks for listening. This is Aches and Gains with Dr. Paul Christo.